Okay, we'd like to welcome everyone to this webinar on advanced, a guide to 1031 exchanges at the advanced level, unraveling the mysteries of advanced 1031 exchanges. So we're happy to have you here. My name is Spencer Taylor. I'm with Mill Creek Commercial. We offer debt-free tenant and common interest in high-quality commercial real estate around the country. Oftentimes a great solution for a 1031 exchange. We are excited to have a good friend, Bill Exeter, join us. Bill is Chief Executive Officer of Bill is Chief Executive Officer of 1031 Exchange Services LLC and the group of services that help support that. Exeter 1031 is a national qualified intermediary service and accommodator that has a wonderful reach across the country and a focus on a high quality customer service experience with every exchange. Bill is a leader both in the industry and a thought leader to help preserve the world of 1031 exchanges in Congress. So, Bill, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be here, Spencer.
We hope you can take this subject of 1031 exchanges and share some advanced tips and tricks and unravel some mystery behind it. And we're so excited to have you. So take it away. And as we kind of go through, we want to remind our audience, please use the Q&A feature to ask your questions. We want to get to every single question. So, Bill, the floor is yours. Welcome.
Terrific. Thank you. And I made a quick change here. Can you still see my slide deck?
We can.
Okay, perfect. Well, good morning, everybody, or good afternoon if you're back east. And I always title ours Unraveling the Mystery of 1031 Exchanges, in this case, Advanced 1031 Exchanges, because there's just lots of information out there that gets confusing. And we get folks who call us and say, you know, I talked to three or four people, I got three or four different answers, and, you know, what really matters? So we're focused on advanced exchanges today, but we can take any questions as we go. So as we go along, you know, like you said, post the questions in the Q&A, be happy to address any questions you might have in 1031 exchanges. We can go as basic or as advanced as you'd like. Just a quick intro for those who have not worked with us before. Exeter 1031 Exchange Services is a qualified intermediary. We handle all types of exchanges. We cover all 50 states. We're also one of the few that will handle foreign property 1031 exchanges. So if you've got a client that has rental or investment property in a foreign country and wants to exchange that for other foreign rental or investment property, we can assist them. We're one of the few qualified intermediaries that has any kind of regulatory oversight. As Spencer mentioned, we have a trust company, so all the funds are held by Exeter Trust. That's licensed, it's regulated and audited by the Wyoming Division of Banking. So that makes us one of the few that has any type of regulatory oversight. We've been doing it for a long time. We're more consultative than more of our competitors. So we're always happy to jump on a call and brainstorm, try to find solutions, especially when you have those difficult challenges, especially in today's world, et cetera. Exeter Trust is the entity that's regulated. It also offers self-directed IRAs and self-directed individual 401k plans where investors want to buy real estate related assets inside of their IRA, as well as some other products and services and what have you. So real quickly, what does that mean? You know, for those of you who've been in the business a long time, if you go back to 2008 when Land America Financial failed, the judge ruled that all of the client funds were actually corporate funds and were not considered client funds. And that threw the whole industry kind of in a loophole. People are a little surprised by that. And that's one of the reasons we decided to start the trust companies to make sure they were held by a regulated entity. So the funds are clearly held as trust funds or client funds and not as corporate funds. So let's jump right in now, especially you know, even since 08, the last decade or so, there's been lots of reasons why you need to think outside the box to get transactions completed, whatever that might mean. And we had the 08 recession created a lot of need for creativity just to get some deals across the finish line. Now, fast forward, we're going into we're in a rising interest rate environment, might be capping out over the next few months, but it is a rising interest rate environment. That creates all sorts of challenges by itself. We're getting more calls related to seller carry back notes, things like that. So all of those kind of complicate the transactions. And the question is, how do we address those? So this slide deck is actually designed for about 60 minutes. So I'm going to skip some of the slides as we go, but it's going to trigger some thoughts and some questions, and then we can kind of go from there. So with an advanced 1031 exchange, there's a lot of different ways to basically pair the 1031 exchanges together. You'll hear people say, oh, there's a way to do an exchange and have a full 1 year. It's not really true. I mean, you have a maximum of 180 days for all of the 1031 exchange strategies and structures, with a few exceptions, but there is that limit. But if you take two different exchanges and kind of meld them together, then you might get a full 365 days. So really depends on what we can pull together. So on the screen, you can see a number of structures that we're going to try to talk about quickly over the next 30 minutes, just to give you a flavor for what can be done. So in some cases, folks are, you know, buying property first, so they want to start off with a reverse exchange, but then they have a need to go into a forward exchange. So they're combining a reverse with a forward. You could do the opposite. You start off with a regular forward 1031 exchange going into a reverse exchange. You might have folks who want to make improvements to the property. So it could be a regular forward exchange or a reverse exchange combined with improvements. So that's always possible too. We'll talk quickly about the non-safe harbor reverse exchange. In this case, it gave you more than 6 months to get the deal done. We're going to talk about building a property you already own. That has risk, and we're going to talk about those risks as well. It's possible to buy promissory notes inside of a 1031 exchange. Those get complicated, but we're going to walk through those as well. And then if we have time, we'll talk about saving a reverse 1031 exchange. So with that, first off, I wanted to cover kind of what happens in today's market when the 1031 exchange fails. And just some quick comments. It's not always taxable in the year where the 1031 exchange started. For example, let's say you sold your relinquished property in December of 2022. You got into 2023, and either you weren't able to identify property or you did, but you couldn't acquire it. What happens? Well, it depends on when the client, the investor, has the right to receive the proceeds from the sale. So if the 1031 exchange documents were drafted properly, they shouldn't have access to the funds under the Treasury regulations until at least the 46th day if they fail to identify anything, or the 181st day if they've identified but decided not to buy anything. And there's a lot of variables in the middle there. But the issue is, when do they have the right to receive the 1031 exchange proceeds? And if that lands in the following tax year, then it pushes the taxable gain into the following tax year. So the key there is to let the tax advisor know that Section 1031 works in conjunction with Section 453, and that allows the deferral of the gain into the following year, just like an installment note or seller carryback note. And there's ways to potentially save that as well. So certainly the qualified opportunity zone is one where if the exchange completely fails, it is taxable. They may be able to do a qualified opportunity zone investment to at least save that transaction. Now, this has got a lot of detailed slides, so I'm going to skip a bunch of them. I'm just going to give you a quick summary. But with a reverse, let's say that the client found a property they wanted. They're going to buy it for $5 million. They want to make it part of an exchange, so they structure a reverse 1031 exchange. And the $5 million property is purchased first and parked, or legal titles held by the qualified intermediary. And then as they're thinking about it, they realize the relinquished property they intend to sell as part of that reverse exchange is going to be valued much greater than the $5 million. Let's just say, to keep the math easy, let's say the sale price is $10 million. So they bought for $5 through the reverse exchange. They got a $10 million sale. Well, they've got $5 million of excess sale value. That's $5 million of taxable boot. Unless they decide to follow the reverse exchange with a forward exchange. So the way that would be structured is the $5 million purchase is closed. We're holding legal title to it as the qualified intermediary. And then from there, they go, they identify the property they're going to sell, and it's a $10 million sale. We will actually take that property and bifurcate it or allocate or split it, if you will, into a 50-50 interest, or, you know, it's whatever the percentage works out to be, in this case, 50-50. So the first $5 million of sale value would be allocated to the reverse 1031 exchange that we already have in process, and that would wrap up the reverse exchange. So they purchased for $5 million, they've sold for $5 million, that exchange is done. The second $5 million is used to start a brand new forward 1031 exchange. And now we have a new 45-day period and a new 180-day period to look for another acquisition to make up the difference for that. So that would be one way to pair the two, starting with a reverse going into a forward 1031 exchange. At the end of the day, you're going to have enough time frame there where you can get both done. It may be close to a full year, but whatever that works out to be. But now we've purchased for five, sold for 10, purchased for at least another five, and we've deferred all the taxes. So great way to kind of solve issues when they're looking to purchase a property first, et cetera. Let me scroll through this real quick.
Hey, Bill, quick question. I've never heard of that. And as I kind of hear you talk that through, it allows you to acquire a property you really want, maybe something that came on the market all of a sudden, you weren't prepared for it. So it allows you to buy the replacement property first and call an audible on which property to sell as your relinquished property. So it doesn't basically pigeonhole you into making a decision that is not really the best decision for your portfolio.
Absolutely. Yep. That's a good point, because that's exactly what it does. It gives you flexibility, so you're not necessarily stuck with that original 180-day window.
Interesting. I love that. Okay.
So, and obviously, the more of these involved, the more you put them together, the more complicated they get. So it certainly has some issues there. We've done almost four in a row. So reverse forward, reverse forward. The final transaction didn't quite make it. I mean, you can kind of keep pairing these together and going down the road, but it gets a little complicated the more pieces you put in there. Let me scroll to, and this next one is kind of the forward into reverse. We kind of described it as we go. So it's kind of the same concept, except in this case, you start off with a sale. Let's say you sell for $5 million. You go into purchase, you buy for $10 million. And then you decide, wait a minute, you know, I've sold for five, I'm buying for 10. I'd really like to sell another property to make up for the other $5 million rather than just increasing my position overall. So same type of structure. We start a forward exchange, we sell $5 million, we get to the purchase of $10 million, we bifurcate it, split it 50-50, allocate some to wrap up the forward, and then take the balance to start a brand new reverse exchange. So the second $5 million of value would be parked, meaning we'd hold legal title to that. And then you have the rest of the 180 days to, or sorry, in that case, you'd have a brand new 45 and 180 days to actually go out and find a second relinquished property that you own that you would like to sell and pair with that. So same as the one we described before, except you're selling first, starting with a forward exchange, going into a reverse exchange. And I'll pause real quick. Any questions that are on point there?
No, but when you're ready to talk about seller financing and 1031 exchanges, there's a few questions around that topic.
Okay, gotcha. Why don't we take that one now?
Sure.
I don't think I've got that on the slide deck. And certainly today, we're getting a lot of those questions. I mean, literally every day we're getting calls now on seller carryback financing because of the increase in interest rates. The issue there is, and the question you get is, can you do a 1031 exchange with seller carryback financing? It amazes me how many qualified intermediaries will tell you, no, you can't do it, but you absolutely can do it, but it gets a lot more complicated. So effectively, you're looking at a sale, you're going to sell and get 10, 20, 30% cash down, let's say, and the balance will be in a seller carryback note. That's the easy part. The tough part is, how do you use that seller carryback note to complete your 1031 exchange? You know, your net proceeds are not just the cash. Your net proceeds include the seller carryback note. So the first question we get after that a lot is, well, can I do an exchange down the road when payments come in? Can I do an exchange down the road when the balloon payment comes in? The answer is no. Those payments down the road are just debt payments or debt payoff. it's not considered a sale of real estate. So the actual sale of real estate occurs up front. That's what triggers your 1031 exchange requirements and deadlines, et cetera. So let's say it closes today. Today starts your 45 days and your 180-day window. So how do we deal with that seller carryback note? That's the big issue. There's a couple, you really have five options there to deal with a seller carryback note. First option is you go, oh, well, I did a seller carryback. It's not going to work. So I see if the cash portion could be done through a 1031 exchange and would it defer any taxes? That's the question. Would it provide any benefit or is it trading down in value so much that there'd be no 1031 exchange benefit? And then the seller carryback would be just taken outside of the exchange, treated as an installment note and taxable over the term of the note. Not ideal, obviously, because that's expensive. You're paying the tax. Second option, which is probably the best, but not necessarily practical. None of these options are really practical. But second option would be if the investor has sufficient cash to put into the 1031 exchange, then they can actually act as the lender. So let's say it's a $1 million seller carryback. They would actually put the $1 million into closing, and then the promissory note would be drafted in their name or their entity name because they're acting as the lender. So they're really lending the borrower, the buyer, $1 million in cash, and they're getting a promissory note secured by a mortgage or a deed of trust. That's the most effective way to do it because they're really lending the money. When the sale closes, you now have all cash in the 1031 exchange, and it's easy to finish and wrap it up. But that's a lot of cash to come up with in a lot of cases, and a lot of investors can't do that. Doesn't really matter what the source of the cash is, could be financing or what have you. But if they can do it, great. The third option would be they say, I can come up with the cash, but not right away. The promissory note would have to be drafted in our name as the qualified intermediary, and then later they would deposit the cash into the 1031 exchange account, and then we've got all cash to proceed. And after the 1031 exchange is completed, then we assign the note to them. Similar to the second one, but cash comes in later. Fourth option is to say, I can't come up with the cash. Let's put the promissory note in the qualified intermediary's name so it's all inside the 1031 exchange. And then let's sell that promissory note. So you sell the note. It could be to an investor. It could be a related party. Doesn't matter. The challenge there is most investors or note brokers are probably going to want a pretty significant discount so they can get the yield up to 15 to 20% in most cases. So that's expensive, but that's an option. It can certainly work. And if the capital gain is large enough, it might be worth it. And final option is you find a seller of replacement property that says, I'm willing to take that note as part of my consideration. So you go, great, we buy the replacement property, we transfer the cash we're holding to them, and we endorse the note and assign the mortgage or deed of trust to the seller, and now they're fully paid. But as you know, a lot of sellers won't touch a third-party note. So those are really your five options to deal with seller carryback financing. You said there was questions specifically on point?
Yeah. So thanks for reviewing that. Bill, John asks, regarding your reverse to forward bifurcating the property, I thought you couldn't split it up and exchange in the same year.
No, you could certainly do that. You have to be very careful how you do that. So you have to make sure that you specifically set up two separate 1031 exchanges, two separate document packages, and assign into the transaction twice. So it does have to be split up and bifurcated in order to do that, but it can't be done in the same tax year.
Good. Okay. Good.
Other questions on seller carry or?
Okay. Alex asks, in the case of the seller is trying to 1031 exchange, does the down payment from the buyer get deferred? Is there a way to defer the taxes for the balloon?
Good question. So that kind of alludes to the fact that with one of the options where you keep the installment note outside of the 1031 exchange. So I'm actually working with a client today that's closing one today, and I'll use the numbers in that example. So he is selling a relinquished property for $5 million. He's got a $4.5 million seller carryback note, $500,000 in cash. After closing costs, his cash that he's going to get is about $330,000. And then a $4.5 million seller carryback note. First question that we asked him was, what's your current adjusted cost basis in the property? Depending on what that is, that $500,000 or actually the $330,000 in cash probably won't provide any benefit. In his situation, after we talked to the accountant, his cost basis on his tax for a current tax year was about $300,000 to $400,000. So the answer there is it would not provide him with any benefit because he'd only be rolling over about $330,000 in cash, and his cost basis is right about that same level. So the only thing he would defer would be his cost basis. You know, he might defer $10,000 or $20,000 in gain, but in my opinion, that's not enough to go through all that process. Now, if his cost basis was almost zero and he had $500,000 in cash, then absolutely, you could exchange just the cash portion, and at least it would defer, you know, almost $500,000 of gain. So it depends on your current adjusted cost basis in the property.
Bill, we had a client years ago who was selling an infill lot in downtown Salt Lake. She sold it on terms, but was worried about her 1031 exchange. So I think they paid maybe half up front, and she carried a note for 4 months. So the balloon payment was within her 180-day window to allow her to basically, okay, I'm going to give you a little bit of leeway, but I need all the funds to complete my exchange on my end. And, you know, I think it was $750,000 or maybe $1 million. It wasn't that big, but they came to an agreement of, hey, the balloon needs to be inside my 180-day with enough time to close on my replacement property. So that's another way it can happen too.
Yes, absolutely. And the key there is make sure you work with your closing, either escrow, title, or closing attorney. Review the promissory note and deed of trust or mortgage before closing occurs, before they're recorded. In that case, it should be drafted in the qualified intermediary's name. So it's in the 1031 exchange account. And then when the payoff comes in, it's part of the 1031 exchange.
Yeah, good
point. What we found a lot is closing agents don't really understand how that works. And a lot of times they put it in the actual client's name, record it, and then it's too late. It becomes really net proceeds that are taxable as taxable boot.
Good point. Thank you, Bill, for outlining that.
Sure. Next advanced topic is kind of a reverse improvement. It could also be a forward improvement. So you're either buying property first, we take title to the property, what they call parking title, and then you've got the next 180 days to do two things: make improvements to the property. Any improvements made during the time that we hold title to the property are going to be considered part of the reinvestment. And then you also have to sell your current property within that 180-day window, since it's a reverse exchange. If it's a forward exchange, same thing, you sell first, you're going to buy, and then we take title to the property you're buying, and then you have the rest of the 180 days to make improvements. The challenge with these is it's only 180 days or less. Getting permits can be very difficult, if not impossible, within a six-month window. So you don't see a whole lot of these, but it is possible there. Let me advance forward here. Non-safe harbor reverse exchanges. So reverse exchanges, of course, you're buying first and then you're selling second. You have 45 days to identify what you're going to sell, because you buy first and identify what you're going to sell. Then you have another 135 days after the 45-day window to complete the sale. So a total of 180 days. Years and years have gone by, and we've done non-safe harbor reverse exchanges where it's outside the 180-day window. Those always have risk because there's not a whole lot of guidance out there. We now have a tax court case where they did it. It was structured as a 24-month reverse improvement exchange. It was actually completed in 17 months. The IRS disallowed the 1031 exchange. They fought it in tax court. They won. The tax court said, yes, it's perfectly okay. The IRS has also come back on various panels and said, yes, but we still hate them. So it's still a risk because we know the IRS would probably audit and review, et cetera. But for those who need to buy, make improvements, maybe for a business operation, and then sell and do a reverse improvement exchange, we do at least have one court case that would allow that. And that one's referred to as the Bartell versus Commissioner case, if those of you who want to look that sucker up. Reverse exchanges, real quick, have issues. They're more complicated. Number one, we're holding title to the property, not the investor. Lenders have issues with that. Traditional lenders probably won't touch it. So you have to take a look at those type of issues. We're going to hold title in an LLC that's a brand new LLC set up just for that particular client. Some lenders will not lend to an LLC. The documents, loan, promissory note, et cetera, have to be non-recourse to us as the exchange company. Some lenders just will not allow any non-recourse provisions in there. So those are kind of the issues that you have to worry about. The investor can certainly guarantee the promissory note. They can cross-collateralize and things like that. So it's possible. Certainly private money, hard money lenders will look at that. Portfolio lenders will often look at that. Life insurance lenders, you know, typically will look at that. But the traditional lenders probably won't. But if you've got the right relationship with the right loan officer, et cetera, they could. So it depends on kind of the relationships there. Next is building on property already owned. This has risk. A lot of qualified intermediaries will tell you, no, you can't do that. You have to buy property that you already own. You can't build on property that you already own. But the IRS has actually come out with three private letter rulings. They're referenced on your screen, and we can certainly send you links later if you want. The private letter rulings essentially allow the taxpayer to build on property they already own. Here's the risk. There's different levels of risk. First level of risk is we only have three private letter rulings. Now, first, we're usually lucky to have one private letter ruling. So in this case, we have three. But a private letter ruling is where an investor has written to the IRS through their attorney or CPA or whomever and requested a ruling and said, here's exactly what we're going to do. Does it qualify or does it not? And if the IRS issues a private letter ruling, then they're saying, yes, it qualifies, et cetera. They delete or redact all the confidential information. They publish it so you or I can read the private letter ruling and see exactly what the IRS said, but we are not permitted to use that or cite that as precedent. So we could do exactly the same thing, and if the IRS wanted to, they could disqualify the transaction. So you've got that level of risk that there's no way to guarantee that it would qualify. Number two, the further the investor strays from the private letter ruling, the more risk they take on. So we don't have time to go into detail there, but just wanted to plant that it is possible, but there's complications, there's risk, et cetera. Let me fast forward here. Let's cover buying a promissory note in a 1031 exchange. Now, most people are going to say right off the bat, that doesn't qualify because a promissory note is a personal property interest. It's not a real property interest, and they're absolutely right. However, using the improvement 1031 exchange, some people call it a build-to-suit or construction 1031 exchange, it's possible to structure this. So effectively what happens is you do a forward 1031 exchange, you're selling your existing property, you identify the real estate, not the promissory note, but you're identifying the underlying real estate that secures the promissory note. The promissory note is probably well into foreclosure. So they've probably already recorded a notice of default. They're probably very close to the trustee sale or something like that. And effectively what we do is we will go out as the qualified intermediary. We'll either bid at the trustee sale or, you know, whatever the transaction might be there. If we're the winning bidder, then there's going to be a trustee's deed or a sheriff's deed, et cetera. And then we get title to the real estate. So we have now converted the promissory note from a personal property interest, i.e. a promissory note, into a real estate interest by getting that trustee's deed or sheriff's deed, et cetera. Now we actually own fee simple in that real estate. Now we can transfer the real estate that we're holding to the client. So they effectively sold real estate. They identified real estate, we converted the promissory note into real estate and then transferred the real estate. So they did sell and then buy real property. So when you're in markets like today where we're going to have some distressed properties, distressed notes, it is possible to do that. The risk is, as we all know, trustee sales can be postponed numerous times. So if they postpone it right past the 180-day deadline, you've got a problem. It could be structured in a reverse exchange format. So you wait, you keep bidding and whatever. And if you finally win on a specific property and we take title to it, or we end up with the promissory note and then we end up taking title to the property through the sale, then you can sell your current property. So it works in a forward or a reverse structure, but it's a creative way to deal with a promissory note that you might like to get the underlying real estate on. And any questions on point so far?
Nothing on that.
Okay. So the next one is saving a reverse 1031 exchange. And, you know, a lot of folks will go out and buy property first, make it part of a reverse 1031 exchange transaction. They've got 180 days to sell their property in order to wrap that reverse 1031 exchange up. The question is, what happens if it's, you know, a property that's difficult to sell or whatever, and you can't get it sold by the end of the 180 days? One option is to have a related party buy that property from you. So effectively, you are selling to a related party. The related party is buying your relinquished property to let you wrap up that reverse 1031 exchange and let it qualify. The downside is the related party has to hold that property for 2 years. They can't turn around and immediately sell it. So it is a way to save that reverse exchange if needed, but there is that two-year holding period. And we already talked about failed exchanges. I'm going to pass on that one. We're going into challenging times again. Who knows if there's a recession that's coming or not, and whether it arrives. But if you find a client who's in a situation where they've done a number of exchanges, they own an asset, they've refinanced over and over to take advantage of the lower interest rates. So maybe a best example is you bought property for $1 million. Over time, it keeps going up in value to now it's $5 million. You've been refinancing over and over and over. So maybe your outstanding debt is $4.5 million and a recession hits. And whatever that might be, maybe it's office and for many reasons, the value of that property drops to say $3 million. And maybe it goes into foreclosure, maybe they have to do a short sale, whatever it might be. A lot of times the investor says, well, I'm not getting any cash out of this. I owe more than what the property is worth. Therefore, I'm just going to let the property go. I have no tax consequence. Well, that's not true because they bought the property for $1 million. They've probably also been depreciating it over time. So the cost basis is probably lower than $1 million. But then they turn around and it's gone all the way up to $5 million and it drops to $3 million. They owe $4.5 million on it. So yes, it is negative. They don't have any equity there. However, their cost basis, let's just say, is $1 million. Their current fair market value is $3 million. There's a $2 million gain. So if they let the property go through foreclosure or short sale or fire sale or whatever it might be, they have a taxable gain there, whether they like it or not. A foreclosure is a sale of real estate. It's a forced sale, but it is a sale for tax purposes. It's possible to do what we call a zero equity 1031 exchange. So they would effectively have to have their tax advisor calculate what the deemed sales price was for the property they lost through foreclosure or what have you. And then from there, they would still have to do it through the qualified intermediary. The difference is we're going to do everything we would normally do to structure the 1031 exchange. We may have to take title to the property if there's no purchase and sale agreement. If it's a true foreclosure and the lender's not willing to work with the investor, then there's no purchase and sale agreement that can be assigned to us. We may have to take title to it under the old pre-1990 structure. But in any event, we can set it up as a 1031 exchange. When the quote-unquote closing occurs, which is probably the trustee's sale, there is no equity, no cash coming to us as the qualified intermediary, but we can say we have acquired and conveyed title to the buyer, which in this case is the winning bidder. They can identify during the 45-day window what they're going to acquire, and then they can go ahead and finish the exchange within that 180-day window. The challenge there is, you have no equity, so how do you do that? So we've had clients who do it strategically on purpose. We've had clients who've just come to us and said, this is what's going on. I have no options. So in some cases, the zero equity 1031 exchange may not work. They don't have the creativity. They don't have the cash or other resources. But those who do have the resources, it can be done. So if you've got a client who has no equity, make sure their tax advisor looks at it to see if there's a taxable gain. And if there is, we can still look at potentially doing the 1031 exchange transaction on it. And I mentioned this briefly at the beginning, but one of the things you can use today is the qualified opportunity zone to save a 1031 exchange. The question is exactly when does the 180-day period start running for the qualified opportunity zone? So most people think it's the sale of the relinquished property, but it could be later because remember, Section 1031 works in conjunction with Section 453, which is the installment sale code. So in some cases, you actually may have more than 6 months to make the qualified opportunity zone investment, but great way to potentially save a failed 1031 exchange. And I think we're a little bit over the 30 minutes. So that was a whirlwind tour of advanced 1031 exchanges.
So Bill, I'm listening to you, and a lot of these strategies I'm not familiar with. And I hope everyone listening just walks away with this idea of, I need to call my QI and talk through what's going on, ask questions, and then ask the question, what else do I need to know about this? And the QI, you, Bill, hopefully they call you. I hope they do. You can walk through options and strategies. And like you said in the beginning, you know, take on more of a consultative approach on, okay, here's how we can solve this problem that you're trying to solve.
Absolutely. That's what it's all about, is looking outside the box and say, okay, the investor has a challenge or a problem. How do we solve that? And obviously, best case scenario is you get the investor, the agent, and their tax advisor and probably legal advisor on a conference call and say, okay, here's some possible solutions. What do you guys all think? There's not necessarily one solution that's right for everybody. So it just depends.
Yeah. Good. Okay. We have a couple of questions here. Somebody asked, if you're looking at doing a 721 exchange, do you need to use an accommodator? Bill, help us understand first, what's a 721 exchange?
Sure. Good question. The answer is actually, it's my favorite answer. It depends. But everybody hates that. So first of all, a 721 is actually a tax-free contribution of an asset to a partnership. So, you know, you and a couple buddies get together and you're going to set up an LLC, which is going to be treated as a partnership for tax purposes. You decide, okay, we're going to each contribute something different. I'm going to contribute my real estate, which is the kind of the start of the whole thing. So under Section 721, I can contribute that property into the partnership by deeding it into the partnership. And that's a tax-free contribution under Section 721. Now, there's different ways to use that from a 1031 exchange perspective. So you've probably heard other terms out there. Some people call it an UPREIT. Some people call it a 1031/721 exchange. Some people call it a 721 exchange. And there's really kind of two common structures or strategies. One is, if you've got property that the REIT wants, or if your portfolio is large enough and the REIT wants that, it may be a pure 721 contribution where you literally contribute your property into a partnership owned by the REIT, and the REIT will give you operating units in that partnership. And that's a direct contribution, and you don't have to do a 1031 exchange at all. It's literally just a contribution into that REIT. I've oversimplified that, but it gives you an idea. In most cases, investors have property that the REIT really doesn't want, you know, maybe a bunch of single families or what have you. And so what they do is they will sell whatever their real estate is. They will do a 1031 exchange transaction. That's the first step. The replacement property will be identified as a fractional interest in the real estate that the REIT is putting together. That could be, you know, a tenants in common structure. It could be a Delaware statutory trust structure. I think probably today more common than anything, it's a Delaware statutory trust, but both work, a TIC or a DST. You then hold that investment, and it depends on the sponsor, for probably 1 to 2 years. That's the first stage. That's the holding period. You 1031 exchange out of your current property into this large asset. You hold it long enough to prove intent to hold for investment. And then the second step kicks in. After that holding period, that entire property with all of those underlying investors is contributed into the operating partnership that's owned by the REIT. And that's the 721 contribution. You're not really in the REIT, but you're in a partnership controlled by the REIT. And that allows you to participate as if you were in the REIT. You get the cash flow from the REIT, you get the diversification from the REIT, et cetera. So hopefully that answered your question. The one thing to keep an eye on there is, if you're doing that structure, read the private placement memorandum very, very carefully. Because you're not actually in the REIT, you're in a partnership and you have operating units in the partnership. When the REIT decides to sell that asset that you bought into, it will trigger the gain and get distributed. The gain gets allocated or distributed to all the partners in that partnership. do you need to understand when could that property be sold? Can it be sold? You know, can they just sell it without your approval? In most cases, yes, they can sell it whenever they want. Some will give you a 7, 10, 13 day guarantee that they year guarantee that they won't sell the property and trigger your gain until after that time frame. But you need to understand what risk there might be there.
Wonderful. Eddie asks, may we have a replay of the presentation and slides? And let me say that this will be made available for on-demand viewing. Everyone will get a link to this. They can go back and rewatch it. But the slides, Bill, are you able to share these slides with anyone who would like them?
Oh, sure. Yeah, be happy to do that. Okay. You talk so fast. It was a lot of information crammed in a very short period of time.
Red asks a really interesting question. He asks, is it possible for an LLC to sell a property to another LLC with both LLCs being the same person / group for the purpose of another acquisition of property?
Good question. So it goes back to my favorite answer again. It depends. So it's probably going to be treated as a related party transaction. But that's the first question, is you have to look at the ownership, the underlying ownership, and determine if it's a related party transaction. Based on the way it's described just now, it's probably a related party transaction. Related party transactions get very complicated. So I'll try to shorten the what works and what doesn't work. First, if you're selling to a related party, that's easy. You can certainly sell to a related party, and the only requirement is a 2-year holding period. And then after the 2 years, you can do whatever you want to do. So the related party who sells to another related party, very easy to structure that as part of a 1031 exchange. Just make sure the related party holds that for 2 years. Buying from a related party is a whole different ballgame. And part of the problem is the code and the regs just talk about the 2-year holding period. But there's a revenue ruling out there that complicates it. And effectively, when you're buying from a related party, it probably won't work. But there are exceptions. So, for example, one of the exceptions is if you're buying from a related party and the related party also does a 1031 exchange, then both parties are tax deferred and both will qualify because there is no tax recognition event. So that's one option, one exception. The second is if we can show that the related party is going to just cash out, pay the tax, and if we can show that they paid equal or greater taxes than what the seller is deferring through their 1031 exchange, so we're showing there's no tax avoidance going on, then it would also qualify. And that's really what it boils down to. As long as we can show there's no tax avoidance going on, then it will work. But in a lot of cases, the structures that we're presented with, it probably won't work because it kind of ends up with tax avoidance, not necessarily on purpose, not trying to defraud the IRS. It's just the way they structure it. They're buying out a related party probably to help them to solve a problem, and they don't realize, but the related party is going to cash out, pay no tax. And in that case, it wouldn't work. So it depends on all the parties and all the tax consequences.
Also with this question, you know, someone might own property, just maybe them and their spouse, 123 Main Street LLC, owns the property located at 123 Main Street. They sell it. They want to do a 1031 exchange into the property at 123 Center Street and create a new entity, 123 Center Street LLC. If both of them, now correct me if I'm wrong, if both of them are pass-through entities or disregarded entities, in other words, the person who owns the entity is the same person paying the tax, then they can easily do that one LLC into another. It gets really complicated if there's more than one taxpayer in the owning the LLC. I don't know if you want to touch on that element.
Sure. Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. You know what, as you're asking the question, I was kind of thinking here's a good professional quote for you. A lot of stuff on the internet says that you have to have the same legal title holder. So when you sell your relinquished property, buy your replacement property, it has to be the same legal title holder. And that is not necessarily true. It's an easy way to explain it, but you hit the nail on the head. What really matters is the same taxpayer. So what you just gave in the example is perfectly okay. So you've got two different entities. They're both disregarded entities. That's the key. they're disregarded for tax purposes. So they're treated as if the husband and wife are the real owners. So they're really selling relinquished property, even though it's through an LLC, it's really husband and wife selling real estate because it's a disregarded entity. And it's the same husband and wife buying the new replacement property because it's also a disregarded entity. Probably the more common thing you'll see out there is, you know, a taxpayer owns property in, let's say, an LLC, and maybe a single member, it might be a partnership, and they sell that and they go to buy the replacement property, and the lender says, we will not lend to an LLC. So then we have to look at that. And if the LLC is a disregarded entity, it's treated as if the underlying member is actually the taxpayer. That member could buy the replacement property in their individual name because that is the same taxpayer, and then later contribute the property into the LLC. If that LLC is a partnership for tax purposes, that will not work because that would change the underlying taxpayer. So we have to drill down and figure out who's the real taxpayer, and then it has to be the same taxpayer all the way through.
And again, these are complicated, and most people aren't in this world day in and day out. So call up Bill. Bill, this is my situation. What do I do? Here's all the information, and he can counsel you through the best avenue, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, happy to chat and kind of walk through your situation, let you know. Happy to jump on a call with you and your tax advisor, legal advisor, what have you, and kind of walk through the issues.
Rhett asks a follow-up question. Can a property that's held in a trust use 1031 exchange?
Yes, any kind of trust can do a 1031 exchange. Kind of the same issue. Who's the real taxpayer? If it's a living trust, which is considered a fully revocable grantor trust, then it's really a disregarded entity. It's treated as if the husband and wife, or if it's just one person, whoever that person is, as the taxpayer, then really it's the individuals that are the quote-unquote taxpayer. They would sell, they could buy the replacement property. It could be in the trust name, or if the lender says, we're not going to do that, it could be in their individual names. If the trust is an irrevocable trust, so usually that happens when husband and wife have both passed, the trust is now irrevocable. It is considered a separate, distinct taxpaying entity, probably has its own EIN number by then. It's probably filing a 1041 tax return. So the trust can sell and do an exchange, but the trust would have to buy the replacement property as well, because that is the taxpayer, is the irrevocable trust.
Yeah. Well, Bill, there's no more questions left. Thank you so much for taking the time to share kind of these advanced approaches to 1031 exchange. You know, there's a lot of information here that can be helpful, and we hope that all of our participants know that they can call Bill and talk to him and ask him their questions and pick his brain. No question too small, right?
Absolutely. Yep. Any questions, fine with me. Not a problem.
Wonderful. Again, this will be made available on demand. It'll be emailed to you here shortly. Bill, thank you for your time, your expertise, and willingness to share. And this will conclude the webinar. Thank you so much.